This morning, please join me in welcoming our speaker today, Marilyn from the Pacific Group in Los Angeles.
Hello, I am Marilyn Slater, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
And I'm always amazed when any alcoholics are awake on Sunday morning. And thank you all for coming. And workshops imply work. This is Sunday morning, so we're going to work, even though it is Sunday, a day of rest for many people. And Dave has so kindly provided pens and tablets to help with this workshop, so feel free to use that. You can write notes if you want, but there is going to be a period where we're actually going to use them for a little self-examination. We're going to talk about the 11th step today. We heard the steps read, and we probably all know the 11th step, but it's sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for His knowledge, the knowledge of His will for us, and the power to carry that out. So we're going to have a workshop entirely devoted to this one step. But this is a complex step, and we're going to examine the three aspects of it. It emphasizes prayer and meditation, so we're going to use that as our instrument for improving our conscious contact with God. That's one aspect, to improve our conscious contact with God. Also, it advises us to seek God's will and to seek the power to carry that out. We're going to have three short periods of meditation that kind of focus on those three aspects of the step. And as we reflect on this step, there'll be time for comments and questions, too. We're going to do a little bit of writing with one of those periods of meditation. I want to share a little bit about my own experience, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We have no theology here. We have no accepted concept of God. We don't even try to describe God. We talk about the path to God. We talk about the journey, the spiritual journey. And our concept of a higher power is as varied as there are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in my own experience and the experience of the people that I know, that concept changes over time. When I first came to the program, some of you were at the meeting last night, and you may remember that I came into the program as an atheist, a confirmed atheist. I believed in no God with capital N. That was a certainty for me. And my journey has led me to doing an 11th step workshop, which kind of implies that I do believe now that there is some power much greater than myself that acts in our group conscience, that empowers our life, that sustains our life, in fact. Long before I was probably always an alcoholic, but I passed as a social drinker at one time in my life. And during that period, long time ago, as the 60s were getting underway, I was at a party simulating social drinking, so I was still conscious. And it was a party of physicists. My husband is a physicist, and we were there, and there was a very bright physicist from Berkeley, and Gerson Goldhaber. And he was talking about his son, who was a student at Berkeley at the time and had gotten involved in transcendental meditation. That was kind of big in the 60s. And people kind of looked at Gerson and thought, what is that? And he said, you know, I talked to my son, and it's a funny thing. I began to do that. I began to sit in meditation for a half an hour every day. And when I did that, I could do more work. I could do better physics than I've ever done in my life before. It just changed my whole day. And people said, but you know, you're using the past tense. Don't you do it still? You're not continuing that? And he said, no, I really don't. And so then he was asked the obvious question, why not? And he thought about that. I mean, he took the question seriously and he said, I guess I don't like to work that hard. Now, since I was conscious, I just sort of filed that away, that, you know, here's a physicist, and I essentially worshipped science, and I had great respect for the opinions of scientists. And here was a real scientist talking about transcendental meditation and deriving some benefit from that. And then I forgot about it until years later in Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember that. That was... And then I went through what I talked about last night, incomprehensible demoralization, still held on to my atheism, and yet, unlike other happy atheists, I'm an alcoholic. So at one point I was forced to visit Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took root in my life in 1972. So I was faced with this dilemma that our big book talks about. It talks about it in several different ways, but it's sort of, we're presented with a moral choice. We can be doomed to an alcoholic death with a lot of destruction to ourselves and to the people around us. We can be doomed to that, or we can accept a spiritual answer. And it points out that this is a difficult alternative for an alcoholic. It certainly was for me. I just thought, I can't really face either. They're both horrible choices because, on the one hand, I seem not to be able to do anything about the destructive path that my life is on, and the other is something I can't possibly choose because it's so irrational. Luckily, I had a sponsor, and my sponsor could personalize the program for me, and I began right away to say, I don't believe in God. There's so many of these aspects of the program that use that forbidden word. And what do I do? And my sponsor, Marion, said, don't worry about it. And as far as the prayers are concerned, just give lip service to the prayers. Just say them. I couldn't say the word God or Our Father. It reminded me of Ohio and religion. So I would say something to myself like, as we'd stand up to say the Lord's Prayer, I'd say, oh, great force in the universe that brought it about that Marion was the speaker at that meeting that I was brought back to. And then I'd say amen with everybody else. And then I began to shorten that. Force in the universe that brought Marion to that meeting. And then at one point I thought to myself, you know what I could do? I could use the word God, but I don't mean what those people back in Ohio mean. And I was telling an old-timer, John Locke, who was a big, big help to me. I was telling him about that, and I explained that whole thing, my whole logic. And he looked at me, and he just started laughing, just bust out laughing out loud. And I said, why are you laughing? And he said, you're telling me that you mean by God just what you mean, how you understand God. And I said, yeah, it's how I can stomach that term. That's what I mean. And he said, I hate to break this to you, Marilyn, but that's what we're all doing. Now, I am a slow learner on this program, and I didn't even catch the irony and all that until sometime later, until I was talking with some newcomers who were explaining their logic about God to me. But John also said other things about just wear it all loosely. And I told him that I was not religious. I'd never been in an organized religion. And he just looked at me and says, your religion is your life, and your thoughts are your prayers. So I had to think about that, think about the religion that I was practicing. And it was pretty chaotic in those days. My early years were not pretty. And my thoughts are my prayers. And I began to think about that. And my higher power, was myself, because that's what I thought about all the time. And Marianne had pointed out to many times that whatever I am praying to, whatever I call my higher power, will be fine as long as it's not myself. So I consciously had to accept that that maybe I should focus on something outside of myself, and that was the one thing that I could focus on was a series of events that somehow seemed to be working to give me what I needed for recovery, to stay sober, and that was finding a sponsor that was just right for me, coming to understand that I was in a group that was just right for me. Even though I resisted it and didn't want to be in a big active group, I came to see that that's exactly what I needed. And I began to suspect. Now, I'm going to have some pieces of paper here because I want to stay on a schedule. So we're hoping for the best. I looked at old timers. I looked at Chuck Chamberlain, who was still very healthy and very active when I was new, and I am so grateful for that. He was the sponsor of Clancy, our group founder, and would come to our group, the Pacific group, and talk often. And as he walked into a room, it just seemed like more lights went on. And he was probably, maybe he was 6 feet tall, but he seemed to be about 8 or 9 feet tall. And it was as if he didn't walk, he just kind of floated in. And I could see that. He talked about God. He had a tiny voice. Maybe you've heard some tapes of Chuck. Maybe some of you were here when he was speaking. He would talk about, he's our pappy and we're his kids. And then he had a funny little tee-hee-hee kind of laugh. It was so uncharacteristic, but that was Chuck. And the way he talked, I knew that he knew something that I didn't know. He had some kind of relationship with this thing that he called God that not only was convincing to me, but it made me want to know that too. It was a very attractive thing. I also looked out at the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've heard people's stories. I heard my own story when I began to tell it. Look at the clientele we have here. I came in from the garage after many years. People come from all kinds of sordid places, interesting places, but not usually the Menninger Clinic, not usually places that we would talk about in good society. We just come from, well, the gates of insanity and death. We don't come here before we get there. We try everything else. So here we come. Now, what happens when you have a room full of alcoholics? That's called a bar. Well, there are bar fights, usually people throwing up. And yet we all come together, and somehow we bring one another back from the gates of insanity and death. We're alcoholics. Look at where we were, what our lives were like. And yet somehow we come together, and we invoke this thing we call a higher power. And what happens? Those of us that stay around, that stay active, that take these steps, come into some kind of life that we never imagined possible. So I just had to say to myself, as a mad scientist, that was convincing to me, that what more evidence would anybody need that there's got to be something acting here besides human power alone, given the human beings that we bring into this fellowship? At some point, I did take the steps because everybody else was taking the steps. I didn't think they would work for me, but I just wanted to keep up with the gang and get my sponsor's approval. And I tried to take the third step, and that's worded in a kind of religious way. I just uses the word God. It talks about God's will. It was mystical. I said that step. I took that step aloud with my sponsor, with friends. I took it on my knees, and I did not feel transformed by that. Nothing happened when I said that third step, either to myself or out loud. Around that time, a little meditation of Thomas Merton was given to me. People were passing out little cards with this meditation. Now I'm going to read the third step and the meditation of Thomas Merton. And to me, they became equivalent. The third step talks about God, seeking to do God's will, really turning myself over to God, to make something with me that can understand God's will. The meditation of Thomas Merton, on the other hand, says, I have no idea where I'm going. I can't see the way ahead. And I don't know where it's going to end. But it goes on to say that, but I believe that the desire to please God is pleasing to God, really does please God. And if I have that desire in everything I do, then I'll be led along the right path, though I know nothing about it at the time. In other words, if I simply have the desire to please God, I'm going to end up doing God's will. And over the years, I've become convinced that seeking to please God, the best way to do that for me as an alcoholic is to try to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my token of seeking to please God. And it says that I really can't know God's will for me. I think that that was the big hang-up for me, was when do we get the telegram? And I'll do it, but just tell me what it is, I say to outer space. Another prayer that I made that wasn't even suggested in the big book, but it was my prayer that I could say with absolute sincerity, was after observing these things that were happening in Alcoholics Anonymous that truly seemed mystical to me, and trying and not quite understanding the prayers that were written, wanting to have the kind of relationship that Chuck Chamberlain had, I just looked up and kind of over to the right and just said, if you're there, I'd like to get to know you. And if you're really there, I'm willing to go on any path you pick for me. And as I said that, my heart started beating fast, because I knew I had signed a huge contract. But I meant it. I really meant it. Now, for many years after I did that, I thought that just came out of some kind of logic of my own. I just kind of conjured that up. Now I realize that the transformation had already occurred because I was participating in the fellowship. Before a prayer, before Alcoholics Anonymous, any kind of a prayer would have been, and I think I even made this prayer back in Ohio, if you're there, give me a sign, and if you're really there, get to work for me. I mean, if there's some power out there, I've got to use it for what I want. But this prayer was very different. It was testimony that the transformation was occurring in my life already, even though I didn't perceive that. I didn't know that in my mind. But what happened was that I was able to say that in all sincerity. I want to get to know you, and I'm willing to go on any path you pick for me. And that was my attempt to seek. And that's what we're asked to do in this program. It never talks about finding God. It talks about seeking God. And it never describes... Our program does not describe who God is or what God is. It just says that we must be seekers. We're going to have a couple of periods of meditation, three periods, in fact. And we're going to start, I'm going to read a couple of prayers, the third step prayer and this meditation of Thomas Merton. And let us devote this first meditation to our willingness to come into a deeper conscious contact with God as we understand Him, to come into a greater willingness to please God, to come into a greater willingness to do God's will, whatever that is. I'm going to read the two meditations, the two prayers, and then let us relax. Just sit up straight. Our book never tells us how to meditate, but I'm going to tell you what I do. and that is I try to sort of sit up straight, put both feet flat on the floor, kind of put my hands in my lap, and try to empty my mind and tune into what the universe has to offer. If I express anything, it is this fervent desire to increase this conscious contact with God. And we'll meditate for about 3 minutes. And then at the end of that time, we will have time for comments and questions. So let us begin. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. All right, let us come back together. And now, would anybody like to make a comment, or are there any questions about this mystical nature of God's will, your own experience? Yes, Deborah.
Hi, Marilyn. When you were talking about TM, mm-hmm. basically, I've wanted to do it, mm-hmm. and then I read this book about it because I thought it was going to give me the secret, because mm-hmm. everybody that I've talked to TM, they're like, oh, no, I have my special mantra. It's going to cost you $500.
Wow.
And so I've really, that's kind of got me upset, and mm-hmm. and I feel like when I do mm-hmm. my stuff that it's really good, and I mm-hmm. read the book, and mm-hmm. Unified Field and all that, mm-hmm. basically, besides not wanting to pay all that money mm-hmm. to go through all this kind of stuff, it's mm-hmm. like everything that we do here mm-hmm. really is TM, if you want. I mean, it's just like they put this label mm-hmm. and they, maybe it was like $50 30 years ago, but mm-hmm. today it's thousands of dollars.
Mm.
You know, did mm-hmm. you do TM?
No, I don't know anything about TM except I was at a party with physicists. And it had the word meditation in it, and meditation was kind of a loaded word like God for me. And yet, the thing that impressed me was that a physicist talked about meditation. So that gave it some credibility for me, or credence, or whatever the word is. And I never looked into any of these things outside the program, although I've had some curiosity. Once I came to believe that there is some enormous power there, I was kind of curious about how other people tap into that power, and began to read what other people have written, but certainly never really came across TM again. I've heard about, there was a person, Ram Dass, in the old days, Baba Ram Dass, and I've heard some tapes of him, and at one point he talked about the mantra, and he said it could be anything. It could be broccoli, broccoli, broccoli. It's just something you say over and over, but that's... Yes?
I liked that right there because I got lost in the time
mm-hmm.
a couple of times.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. That's as probably as close to eternity as we get, the eternal moment, just being here, present, right now. And it can be a second or it's forever. Mm-hmm. Yes?
It seems like I struggle with my ego a lot
yes.
when I'm doing these kinds of prayer things.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any suggestions for that?
Can you give an example?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, yes. Now that's a good point.
It's a tough thing for me to focus on.
And be empty to
right.
everything. Yeah, I mean we're not empty beings. We're full of so many things, but I think that's a good thing. I make a distinction between prayer and meditation, and what I call prayer is this conversation that we have with what we call our higher power. We're saying things like, I really like golf, help me with my golf swing. That would be a prayer, a petition to God, help me. And meditation, I conceive of as more listening. We say, I need help with my golf swing. And then just wait, hoping for some power to empower our golf swing, or whatever we're asking for. A friend on the program, many of you know, Clint H., says there's three kinds of prayers. Help me, give me, and use me. And help with golf swing. Give me the power. Those are, I think, prayers. Since we're going to be thinking of those things anyway, what I like to do is turn them into prayers. As I said, once John Locke said to me, your prayers are your thoughts, or your thoughts are your prayers, I began to realize that if I am going to commune with some being that lives at the center of me, then I have to talk with that being like I would talk with another person. And this person sustains, this being sustains my life. So then instead of dwelling on, I am a bad golfer, and I have a bad golf swing, it is, thank you, dear God, that I have a nice set of golf clubs. Thank you that I can play on this golf course. I'm not a golfer, so I don't even know the terminology, so I'm going to switch to bicycling because I love my bicycle. And I, when I'm riding my bicycle and there's no traffic and there are pretty trees in the street, I am almost moved to tears, and it becomes a prayer. Thank you. Thank you that I can ride my bicycle. I mean, I'm 66 years old, and that's a good prayer. That's a prayer of great thanks that I can still ride a bicycle. And thank you for this good day. And it just leads me then to be very, very thankful for all of these things that just start out as my own thought. I'm riding my bicycle. Wonder if I'm going to get a flat tire. When I open it up and realize it's actually a prayer and that I am communing with this, my higher power, then it becomes much more of an expression of gratitude. And then sometimes help. I ask for help. If I am lost, help me. Help me find my way back home, or whatever becomes the help me kind of prayer. And all of those, I think, are legitimate prayers. How do we leap from that then to pure meditation? Well, that's going to be our last meditation. But right now, we're still in the helping and give me prayers. These are true prayers.
With myself, anything I've read on meditation, it always goes back to the same thing: watch your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And but with me, the problem that somebody suggested is when other intrusive thoughts come in,
mm-hmm.
instead of fighting with them,
mm-hmm.
I just let them go,
mm-hmm.
Which is easier said than done. But mm-hmm. instead of tangling, like
mm-hmm.
I should be thinking about this,
mm-hmm.
or you just things come in, they float out,
mm-hmm.
and all that, and you just try not to hitch a ride with anything.
Yeah.
But my question is at times my meditation gets good, I get a good routine.
Mm-hmm.
What is there a I know you, this is going to be a blanket statement, but is there an allotted time that would be like
mm-hmm.
considered like the status quo, how long you should meditate
mm-hmm.
for?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there something, because it's like
mm-hmm.
I'll like meditate for 7 minutes and
mm-hmm.
be like, that was positive.
Mm-hmm.
I know, like, if I brought that to somebody, they're like, well, you got something out of this, that's good, but is there like a half an hour mark? Is that like what?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I think we're called. Okay. Okay, the biggest shots I know, and I'm in a very sort of activist, the Pacific group, that's not really big on meditation. We don't talk about it too much. There's Dick M. in Nebraska talks about foot prayers. And so Chuck Chamberlain himself used to talk about just being in a meditative state all day. He'd just say, thank you, I love you, to God. Sometimes say, this is a problem I can't solve. You solve it for me. So he didn't spend a lot of time in meditation. I think alcoholics, we tend to be happier when we're more active. So probably productive meditations may be shorter for us. Thomas Merton, on the other hand, was called to a different spiritual path. He was not an alcoholic. He was called to be a Trappist monk. And he did a lot of productive meditation and wrote books that have helped lots of people. He was very important in my recovery. But he was called into meditations that lasted all day. He didn't speak. He was a Cistercian, which meant you don't speak. He lived as a hermit in a little cottage at Gethsemane in Kentucky. And he just sat there in meditation, and then he did some writing. And he wrote prolifically, and he did speak with other Trappist monks because there were periods when he could actually teach the whatever, you know, people that come into a monastery to become priests and monks. But the rest of the time was spent in silent meditation. And for him, the optimal time was probably maybe 4 or 5 hours at a sitting. So it is what I think we are called to do. Are we called to be more activists, which means we don't spend a lot of time in meditation? Myself, I spend 10 minutes reading something that speaks to me, maybe the Big Book or something outside of AA, and then I spend another 10 minutes in prayer, which is taking up with God all of those things that I need a lot of help with. And we're going to get to that, and that's going to be our second meditation. And then in the last 10 minutes, I try to be open. And as you talk about, if a thought comes in, just say, there's a thought. And then refocus. I don't use a mantra. I just will, if I need to utter something, it is, thank you, I love you. I say to God, thank you, I love you. And try to empty myself of everything, but just that thank you, I love you. And so the whole period in the morning is a half an hour that I spend trying to get centered to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous for the day. But that varies as much as there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that by simply practicing the 11th step, we come into a routine that's just right for each one of us. What I do believe is that there's no wrong way to do it, but I believe ever so strongly that it is important to do it. It is important to honor the 11th step in some way and to seek that way that's right for us. Yes, Aaron.
Hi, I'm Aaron, alcoholic.
Hi, Aaron.
What about the time of day? Do you find that matters, what time of day you do your meditation?
Yes, it matters for me. Morning is best for me because that centers me for the day and reminds me who I am. It reminds me that I am an alcoholic. And it reminds me that I have only two jobs in this world, and one is to participate in my recovery, spiritual growth, and to be an agent of God whenever God says, here's an assignment. That's all I have to do in the world. And I don't know that until I spend that half hour in the morning. Now, our Big Book suggests that at night we review how things went so terribly wrong. And a lot of people do that, but I'm too sleepy at night, and I usually read a mystery or something and fall asleep. So I don't do well at night. But in the morning, I include that, the review of the day before. And that's the second part of my meditation. The second part of my 11th step is taking up with God all those things that I need help with. But again, as I say, I don't think there's any wrong way to do it. Like Chuck Chamberlain said, he just had short prayers all day long. But we have to find the way that's right for us. And it's important to try all of those different ways until we know, this is the thing that is reminding me of my purpose and keeping me in what I perceive to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I think we'll move on and then we'll have more time for discussion and questions and comments and so forth. We're coming to the second part, which is the review of the day, the review of all of those things that have gone wrong with our life. Let me see. Okay, we're going to take a break right now because we're going to turn to the second part. So let us come back in about 10 minutes, get up, stretch, get some coffee. All right, let us begin again, and now we're going to use paper and pencils, or papers and pens, that Dave so kindly provided. This is the part of our 11th step, our morning or afternoon or our meditation, when we have to clear away this wreckage of the present. The 11th step, in a way, presumes that we've taken all the other steps, but I believe that we can begin thinking about meditation, prayer and meditation early on, because we constantly say prayers in Alcoholics Anonymous. We begin with the Serenity Prayer. We end with the Lord's Prayer in many meetings. We say the third step prayer and seventh step prayer. So we are already praying and meditating. So wherever you are in your program, I invite you to consider this. If you haven't taken your inventory yet, this is like a mini inventory. We're asked to do that in the 10th step, take an inventory every day. The 11th step, as our big book advises us, we think again about these things that trouble us, which really is sort of asking us to inventory the day. It was pointed out to me that the original manuscript of Alcoholics Anonymous talked about reviewing the day, the previous day in the morning. The current edition of the big book talks about doing it at night. But whenever we do this in our meditation, we must think, what is bothering me? What troubles me? What weighs on my mind? And often those troubles can be put in two big lumps. And one is those things that are entirely our own, our character defects, those manifestations of self that make us feel bad. And what are those things? Those are fear, anger, resentment, envy, all the seven deadly sins, which I've enjoyed all of them, but I think that sloth and gluttony are my favorites. But in the end, they turn on me. And so that's what we have to think about, that envy is not so delicious when we dwell on it. And those are the things that spoil our day, that keep us from that thing that the big book alludes to, that mystical thing, conscious contact with God, leaping into the fourth dimension. The other thing that hangs us up, the other thing that makes us feel bad, I believe, is harm that we cause other people. And that requires a slightly different remedy. But there are those two big things that make us feel bad. And so it's important to think about that. And this is a workshop, so it's important that we work. And we take writing instrument, pen or pencil, and let us just spend some time, maybe about a minute, and just jot down those things that are really weighing heavy on us. And nobody's going to see this but you. This is truly your own communion with yourself and with your higher power. What's bothering me today in those two categories, those character defects, those things that I do to myself that make me feel bad, and where I've harmed other people? So let us write. Okay, let us spend maybe another minute. All right. Now, as I say, I spend 10 minutes on this aspect of my meditation, but we're just moving along because this is a short period of time. And but you can feel free to get out a pencil and paper and write all day when you get back home. But let's consider the things that we've written this morning. These are the things that upset us. For those harmful things that we did to other people, the program advises us to promptly make amends to these people, apologize, and say, what can we do to undo the damage that we've caused? So in the next part of our writing, let us look at each one of those things that we wrote and then write out what it is in us that makes us feel bad. And if it's harm to somebody else, let us write down what we're going to do about that. If it's those things that are our own shortcomings and character defects, let's look at those and take each one. For example, if you are very, very angry with somebody, then you have to write, what then is the spiritual solution of that? Because we want to feel better. And for me, I like when I ask God for help not to say simply, remove this anger that I feel toward my boss or whoever. I have to ask that God replace it with the opposite. Please, dear God, remove this anger and replace it with an acceptance of this person just the way he or she is. A celebration for that person's life. And then I often, in a moment of ill feeling, say, and God, give that person just what he always wanted, which is the worst thing you could wish for someone. Then I have to clean up my act and pray for the person in a more benevolent way. Or if it's envy. Envy has been a big one for me. I've often watched other people and feel that their lot is better than mine. Like Chris with his BMW. And I think, I've never had a BMW. Why does he get to have a BMW? So I would write that down. And then I have to say, all right, how would God look on this? And I have to say, thank you, God, that Chris has a BMW and that I can ride in it. And let me celebrate the largesse on this earth that some of us have BMWs. And help me accept that I have a Prius. And help me to see the joys in my Prius and learn to love that as much as I would love to have a BMW. And so that's the next step. Examine each thing and write down then what is the opposite of that bad thing that you feel. Let us take, does anybody have an example where you feel like there's some confusion, like there is no opposite, and would like to share that with anybody? Joe.
Lack of time for the things that I love to do.
Ah.
But all the things that are, the wonderful things going on in my life, there just doesn't seem to be any time to do.
Yes. All right, so how would we write down the opposite of that? For me, I have to look at such a thing as a deprivation, the big category of my life. I didn't get just what I always wanted. And then I always have to turn those into help me to accept what I do have and trust that I have enough time to do the things that God wants me to do. And that also goes for money, of course, that often many of us feel that we don't have quite enough. And it, for me, I have to turn that into thank you that I have what I have and show me that that is enough for everything that you want me to do. I do believe that we get enough time and enough resources to do whatever God wants us to do on earth, and I have to refocus on that. But thank you for that example. Good. All right, so let us spend a little time examining each one of those and writing, asking for the positive opposite of those things that make us feel bad. Now, when you finish addressing those items that you wrote down, it's important to go into meditation again and ask for willingness to make amends to anybody that needs, that you caused some harm to. We must ask for the willingness to do that. And we must ask forgiveness for people who have harmed us. Ask that we be able to forgive and for God to forgive those people that have ruined our day. We have to ask that God replace envy with celebration for somebody else's good fortune. We have to ask God to replace fear with courage and faith that God is somehow going to empower us to do those things that are scary. So you can continue writing or go into a couple minutes of meditation, asking for help with all of those items on the list. Let's come back together. And does anybody have a comment? Share any experience or question about this aspect of the 11th step? Yes, Sandra.
Were we supposed to just concentrate on today so far? Because that's what I did.
That's fine. Sure. For those of us who have taken all the steps, this is a daily thing to review locally what happened yesterday that made us feel so bad, and maybe we won't have to repeat it today. But for newer people, there is so much wreckage of the past, too, that if those thoughts intrude, then we can write that down. It really is anything that bothers us today. It's obviously what is hanging us up today, and that's the main thing to get at. And can we do anything about it today to improve our conscious contact?
To continue with that, mm-hmm. I was asking how do I open up more in my meditation background, mm-hmm. And I wrote down several things on it, and as I wrote down the last one, fear of not losing my connection with God. Mm-hmm. I started laughing. And so I numbered them, and then when I got down to the last one, I went, because it's ridiculous and absurd. Mm-hmm. I won't ever lose it. It's always
that's right.
I may not be conscious of it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So when I did the meditation, mm-hmm. it was easy. Mm-hmm. And I just don't push.
Don't
just
push.
Let go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't know whether you could hear that in the back of just being in meditation and praying not to lose that conscious contact with God, and then suddenly realizing that God, as most of us come to believe, sustains us. That is the ground of our being. And we can't lose it. Sometimes we're not aware of it, but that's the whole purpose of meditation, to make us aware of what already exists. Yes, yes, indeed. Yes?
Would you comment on the opposite of the seven deadly sins in general and fear?
That's pride, anger, lust, gluttony, envy, sloth. There's one more.
Lust.
Pride, anger, lust. Greed, envy, sloth, gluttony. All right. Okay. There's two G's. It's EGSPAL is the acronym.
EGSPAL?
Uh-huh. Well, envy, greed, gluttony, sloth, pride, anger, lust, EGSPAL. I sense that you did not study anatomy. That's how everybody remembers parts of bodies. You develop these long acronyms and can name all the cranial nerves or whatever. Okay, greed. Some of them are just so obvious. Sloth, as I said, one of my favorites. I just have to ask to be empowered and to have energy and enthusiasm and incentive to get up and get going and do those things that are clearly in front of me, like job or speaking at Lake Arrowhead or whatever, that requires a little bit of energy. And I have to ask for that because I would truly, I just like to sit in my room. I have a nice room. And envy is a big one, as I pointed out. But I don't simply envy BMWs. I mean, it's just so easy for me to get into that mode of thinking other people's lots are better. And I always have to turn that into a celebration for their life and their good fortune, and to realize that as long as other people are happy, then I can be happy too. I like to be around happy people. So it's, and then gluttony. have to pray for temperance. I can sit and eat certainly a whole sack of potato chips. So I think, well, I'll substitute broccoli. Then I can sit and eat a whole bag of broccoli. I'm just that kind of a person. So anyway, I have to ask for help with that to make me act like a good-mannered, civilized person. L. What is L? Lust. Oh, yes. Well, I'm 66. I don't even have to pray about that one anymore. But you young folks, that cold shower. A. Anger. Yes. Anger, I don't think, is really that bad. You know, I mean, most spiritual practices recognize that anger is a legitimate emotion. What eats us up is, of course, the R word, resentment. So that's what we have to be worried about. Often there's a lot of justifiable anger. You know, if you see an injustice, that's a good emotion. That means you're a good person. And you might jump in and try to assist somebody that's being dealt with unjustly. What we have to guard against is justifiable resentment. That is absolutely hideous. It can eat us alive. It can make us drink. And it is so reasonable because it's perfectly justifiable. You know, if we, there are abuse cases. I have had sponsees who have been abused terribly by horrid uncles and so forth. And that has been a seething resentment. And that's perfectly justifiable. No one should molest a young girl in their home. A little relative who's 8 and 9 years old, that's unjustifiable. So it's, anybody you would tell about that would say, you have a reason to grow up crooked and distorted and have a terrible sex life and hate all men, and perfectly justifiable. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we learn that, but we could feel better if we didn't carry that resentment. So we have to forgive even that. And we have to come to see that that is a sick person and then begin to pray for that person in that person's sickness and realize that that person probably cannot have a happy life without a lot of work. It's sometimes very hard to let go of those things. But I think that once we get to that point where we realize that if we do, we will feel better, then we're halfway home. Then we can begin to pray for that person, to forgive that person, and to do it daily until we don't think about it every day. But that of course, is a big one, and the big book talks a lot about resentment. Pride. Yes, pride. Pride goeth before a fall. Usually when I am proud of something, and I'm asking to be transformed spiritually, something cuts me off at the knees. There is one time in early sobriety, I took a lot of pleasure in making homemade gifts for people. Now, that in and of itself was not a bad thing. It occupied my time. It made me think about other people, and I derived some pleasure for that. I also began to feel like, I have some creative ability here. It really wasn't a work of art, like Barbara's wonderful things. But on the other hand, it was my stuff I was doing, and I hadn't been too creative in my drinking years, so that was good. It was all good. And then I would take this to birthday parties, and the reader, often Clancy, would open it and read it. If it was a homemade card or if it was a homemade present, he'd hold it up, and everybody would say, that's Marilyn Slater again. And I would just kind of swell up. They're noticing me. They're going to like me one day. And one time I kind of forced it. I made this great big elaborate present for a person in our group, Carol M. She hated to talk at the podium at that time. Was very shy about that. So I made her a practice podium, and I taped it, put together cardboard boxes and a little fake microphone, and I got out of magazines all kind of faces, and I made that a big panorama so she could stand there and see that big display of all of these faces. I had Batman and every kind of a face, and microphone, and I even included a bullet, and I said, you have to bite the bullet and then speak and practice at your practice podium. And I just thought, gosh, this is so super. This is going to be it. They really will accept me now, and I'm so proud of this. And it turned out to be one of those third-year parties where nobody opened presents. Some people had brought some presents and cards, but they didn't open them and read them at that time. But I had spent so much time, and this was going to be my coup de grace. And I began to say to people, you know, I made this special thing. It's really funny and good. It's really just kind of hinting, maybe they should open this one. And finally they opened it, and there were, and I was starting to feel good, but I also was feeling a little bad because they didn't open any other present. And Clancy, our group leader at that time, and still, stepped up and he said, the trouble with you is, now that I know, not good. You like group noise too much. Oh, what is he saying to me? And he said, why don't you just try to be like other alcoholics? You're going to make yourself out to be terminally different, and you'll probably go out and get drunk if you keep this up. Just join the ranks. Be a regular alcoholic. And they just turned and walked away, as he can do. And I thought, well, I'm going to go home and kill myself. And so I really had to begin to separate those parts. As with many, many things on those programs, this thing that seems the worst can turn into something wonderful for my spiritual growth, of course. And that was a terribly important lesson. I've said that to many newcomers, many people I work with, who get really proud about the things they do, especially those things that set themselves apart from others. And for me, being not making waves, being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, being anonymous has been so important. And so I have to spend time in those things where I'm trying to use something to set myself apart that I can be proud of as my very own, getting back into that idea that I am simply doing God's will. And if I've done something, it's because God has empowered me to do it. Thank you, God. Thank you that I've been able to do that and carry out this little assignment that you gave me. And an example of that is that I was asked to come teach at one of the universities in Southern California, and I hadn't done that before. And I was excited about that, but also thinking, I can't do it. I'm going to have to tell them I can't do it. And other people I talked to on the program, my own family and colleagues said, of course you can do it. I mean, you're educated to do this very thing. That's you. It's got your name on it. So I just kind of went with that, and I prayed for help with that. And as it went on, I realized I can do this, and it's not that hard. And at the end of that first semester, I was driving home, and I was thinking, this wasn't such a big deal. I can do it. And then I had to realize how much of my prayer life was spent in, God, please give me the courage to get this course together, to plan the course. Get me into the classroom. Help me to do this. I had to ask for a lot of help with it, and I got it. And after I got it, it was almost in that moment where I wanted to take credit for it. Of course I can't. That is pride, not taking credit for those things that God gives me, turning that into thank you. And then greed is what we talked about earlier, wanting, like Joe, what I want is more time. That's the thing that sobriety has given me, is just, it's opened my eyes. The world is a wonderful place. There are so many things to do. I want to put on a backpack and go hiking in the Sierras. I want to get on my bicycle and ride across the country. I want to play with my grandchildren all day long. I want to go to my job. I want to do more in Alcoholics Anonymous, ever more, because that's fun. And I get so enthusiastic, and there are 24 hours in the day. How in the world can I do all those things that I want to do? I want more time. I don't ever have enough time to do all those things that I want to do. And many people I sponsor are newer, and there is more. I never have enough money. If only I had $60, I could get good headshots, and then I could get a good career going. It's just, if I only had more of whatever it is. And it is so hard for me just to get back into that acceptance that I have enough time to do what I want to do. I learned such a lesson from a guy in our group, Mike Finch, was dying of Lou Gehrig's disease. And he knew that, and he was losing the ability even to scratch his nose. Yet he was one of the most spiritually transformed people. Joan knows Mike, yeah. Most spiritually transformed people I've ever known. He was always saying, let's get in the van, let's go to one more AA convention, long after he could no longer walk. Always at AA meetings. Continued to sponsor people to the end, even when the few people who could still understand him had to translate what he was saying. He was always giving. Just looking forward to the next step. Graduation was coming soon for him, and he would move on to the larger life, and knew that. And he conveyed to me that we always have enough time to do what God wants us to do. Lives are never cut short. That's a term that we read about in the newspaper. It's the right amount of time. We're here. Our life is controlled by God. We're given enough time, we're given enough money to do whatever God wants us to do. If the program has taught me anything, it is that conviction. So I don't have to worry about whether I have enough. Of course it's enough. I will not get an assignment that requires any more than that. If it does, it will soon come in the mail, or I will be given that extra year to do whatever it is, to complete that assignment. And that's what I can come to in this meditation. Greed has to be transformed for me into, I have enough, just the right amount, just perfect for me. I think we did all of the expel. All right. Okay, well, let us move on then into the last part, which is more, perhaps more meditative, because we want God really to give us the assignment. As I said, there are three kinds of prayers: the help me, give me, and use me. And the first two aspects of the 11th step have been the help me, give me prayers and meditation. Transform me, give me what I need, make me willing, and so forth. And now we want to ask God to use us. We have to realize that we have to be transformed to be useful to God. We think about the 7th step prayer. It's interesting. This program is not a success seminar. It is that we ask God to change us into beings that are useful. Take away my character defects that stand between me and my usefulness to other people. It doesn't say make me a successful person, a perfect person. It just says change those defects that get in the way of my usefulness to others. It's a very unselfish kind of thing. We don't get just what we always wanted. We get something even more important. We get what we need, and that is to be useful to others. So we're going to consider the 7th step, the 7th step prayer, and the prayer of St. Francis that asks that we be used. In that, we have to look at how we can be an instrument of God. We have to ask for God's help in order to help God, because given to our own judgment and devices, we will help ourselves. It doesn't come natural for most of us to want to be helpful to others. Now, why would we ever ask for such a thing? If we want to be happy, if we want to have just what we always wanted, why would we ever ask to be useful, for God to use us to help others? Given that we are basically selfish and self-centered as alcoholics, why is it important to be altruistic? Well, not because we're naturally that way, but we I think, come around to the acceptance, to the full conviction, the knowledge that that is the only happy life for us. It's another one of those strange paradoxes in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can never be entirely happy until we begin to look outward and try to be of help to other people, to be an agent for God. That's the other aspect of this whole 11th step. What are our two jobs on earth? To learn the spiritual lesson. The other job is to accept the assignment. And you might say, well, what in the world is an assignment? We know from our experience that we don't get telegrams. Well, I can tell you that you can almost be certain that there's an assignment if a suffering alcoholic asks you for help. You can probably take that as an assignment. If you have a job, it's probably your spiritual assignment to go to your job in the morning and or whenever you go to work on your shift and do your job. That's probably an assignment. The assignments are right there. We just open our eyes, and it's usually, strangely enough, the thing that's right in front of us. If we're a mother of small children, we know the assignment. They're hungry. They need baths. There's a lot of work to do. So we're told, and we come to understand that if we do these things, that is the happy life for us, as strange as it seems, when we concentrate on others. I've become convinced that the life of total